Pleased to have Jake Taylor. He got his PhD from Harvard, then went to MIT as a Pappalardo Fellow, and then he moved to the Joint Quantum Institute, which is a superposition of NIST and the University of Maryland. He, a few years ago, won the SAMI, the Samuel Heyman Service Award for the U.S. government, and he's going to tell us about light and matter, which covers a pretty broad range, I guess.
Very much for the introduction, and I want to say thank you to Daniel and to the organizers of the series for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to talk to a bunch of very interesting folks. I have to say that this is actually my second time to Perimeter, and you've grown quite a bit since last time I was here, so I wish you all the best for further growth. I'm going to talk about some work that I've been doing, obviously, in collaboration with many people. And near the end of the talk, I'll really try and spend some time highlighting how various students and postdocs have driven forward these key ideas. But what I'm going to talk about today is really a simple story. And it's about the connections that we can make between photons and phonons, and how we can try and push systems towards a regime in which quantum mechanics plays a very important and integral role in describing the dynamics of systems at larger and larger energy scales and longer timescales. So to give you a brief outline of my talk, I'm first going to go back to basics to some extent and discuss how we manipulate and engineer photonic systems and phononic systems. And this is the fields of photonics and phononics. I'll then talk a bit about this engineering's impact in the field of optical physics, in particular in trying to implement quantum Hall-like behavior with photons. And then I'll move into some of the implications that we've run into when we try and deal with these large systems, when it comes in particular to the question of whether gravity can convey quantum information or not. Now, I understand this is normally a colloquium, so I encourage you to be colloquial and ask me lots of questions as we go. But first, let's talk about photons and phonons. I'm going to assume everyone is very familiar fundamentally with harmonic oscillators. And of course, the wonderful thing about a crystal is you can generally think at the low energies that every atom is trapped in a lattice and it is itself locally a harmonic oscillator. But these harmonic oscillators are coupled, so if I wiggle one, the one next door wiggles. And of course, as I go to longer and longer length scales, this discrete nature starts to disappear, and I get excitations, which are collective excitations of the motion of these particles. And of course, these collective excitations in the continuum limit are exactly what we would really like to think of as phonons. They are the units of excitation. And the particular choice of phonons is going to depend upon the material and how you've engineered it. So in some sense, you have this collection of harmonic oscillators. You have a wave equation that describes these harmonic oscillators. When you go to quantize this problem, you use the normal modes of the solution. And these normal modes are determined by the solutions to the wave equation, given your boundary conditions and materials. And so in some fundamental sense, you get to choose the particular properties of your constituent particles by designing your system appropriately. This ability to control the nature of excitations in the system enables you to do some very interesting physics. Now, I've told you this story in the case of matter in the condensed phase. Of course, it's also true for the case of light. Again, I solve some wave equations. Here they're Maxwell's equations, given my boundary conditions. And I can engineer how light is going to behave. And the canonical example of that is the Fabry-Perot cavity, the key concept behind cavity QED. You should think of this as two mirrors with very high reflectivity. The mirrors set the boundary conditions for Maxwell's equations. I get standing waves inside. These standing waves, then I would like to quantize as photons. And by controlling the structure of my cavity, I control which modes exist and where they have electric field and magnetic field density. So again, I can engineer my photons by using control of their boundary conditions and the material properties. One of the fun things about working with photons and phonons is that engineers and physicists and industrialists have made great strides in the last 30 years in making materials where these properties have to be now considered at the quantum mechanical level. And in particular, I'd like to highlight just a few pieces from the literature where some amazing physics is happening, taking advantage of these advances. My favorite example is actually silicon nitride membranes that you get from biology supply houses. And so for $40, you can get a 5 millimeter by 5 millimeter by 40 nanometer membrane, which has an intrinsic mechanical Q of about a million at a megahertz. If you take this thing and you cool it down to 4 degrees Kelvin, you have an oscillator that you need quantum mechanics to describe for $40. Similar improvements have been made in other materials, in particular some of the work you've been doing at NIST with glass, where the ability to get into the quantum domain may actually persist even at room temperature. The wonderful work happening in labs across the world working with superconducting materials, where you can take advantage of the very low loss for electric excitations in superconductors to make very high quality factor cavities, cavities that have a very large number of oscillations before information or photons are lost. And of course, Serge Haroche is the most famous proponent of these types of microwave resonators, where his resonators, the photon, will bounce around 100 billion times before it's lost. And in fact, at the temperatures they operate, it also bounces around 100 billion times before it dephases. These are incredibly long-lived quantum systems. Another area there's been great growth is in building structures using nanofabrication techniques where you trap light into waveguides. So this here is from one of my colleagues at NIST, Kartik Srinivasan's group, where they have a ring whispering gallery mode resonance associated with the trapped mode of light traveling inside this piece of silicon. And these whispering gallery mode resonators are also extremely easy to create from the sense you can fabricate many of them and work extremely well in the sense they have extremely high quality factor. They have many oscillations before the photon is lost or dephases. And then the last version is these so-called photonic and phononic crystals, where you start with your individual atoms, you make a crystal, you build a lattice, and then you take the lattice and you make a superlattice. And so I now have a longer length scale. Here you can see it in the size of these little holes here. And this sort of superlattice provides another pseudo-medium, or a metamaterial. Conveniently, the wavelength of light at 100 terahertz and the wavelength of a phonon at 1 gigahertz is about the same. And so you can make a simultaneous phononic and photonic crystal where you're matching 5 orders of magnitude of frequency difference by a 5 orders of magnitude difference in the speed of propagation. All of these devices are ways to engineer and control the nature of the excitations in our system. So let's talk about how we actually move these things around and manipulate them. And I'd like to remind everyone of the most familiar electromechanical system, the one I'm using right now, which is the microphone and the loudspeaker. So you imagine, if you will, a pair of parallel plates connected to a voltage source. This is, of course, just a parallel plate capacitor. You can expect that when I move the plate, the capacitance changes. The change in capacitance produces a sideband on my voltage. And so you have a connection between changes in voltage to a change in capacitance to a change in position. This allows the sound waves from my voice to drive the microphone, to generate electrical signal to go to the loudspeakers, to drive the loudspeakers to generate phonons back. Fortunately, we're not in a feedback mode, so you can hear me without covering your ears. And these systems have been around a long time, and they typically operate in sort of a broadband mode. But as early as the 1940s, some clever folks realized that there's better ways to use these systems. And I'd like to mention Theremin's thing as a great example of a clever thing you can do. So in 1945, the Soviets gave the US ambassador, at that time an ally, a copy of the Great Seal of the United States for his office. And over the course of the following 7 years, the US intelligence community was baffled as to how it was that the Soviets were able to listen in on the ambassador's conversations. They swept that office for bugs countless times. Now, Leo Theremin is a clever guy. He built a nice musical instrument that I happen to like quite a bit, in which you manipulate the sound by moving your hands to change interference patterns of radio waves, the theremin. But he also built this little bug inside that Great Seal. It's an entirely passive device. This can, with an antenna attached, is a high-quality factor microwave cavity at 330 megahertz. It has a thin metal membrane on the surface, so the sound waves move the resonance conditions of the cavity. And it's hooked up to an antenna such that when you shine a radio wave on this antenna, you get sidebands back on your radio wave. And those sidebands read out the signal of people talking in the room. So the changing position is changing the resonance frequency of this cavity. They did eventually find this. This is in the NSA's museum, if you ever come down to Maryland. Now, that same idea that changing position changes the resonance frequency is really the basis for the field of optomechanics, in which we couple light and motion together. Again, I want to recall the Fabry-Perot cavity. So here's a Fabry-Perot cavity, two mirrors. But this mirror is mounted on a spring. The standing wave condition in the cavity is, of course, just that I have an integer number of waves inside the cavity. If the mirror moves a little bit, because the spring is oscillating, this resonance condition is changing. And so I have that the frequency of the cavity is a function of the position. But what about that piece of material that's moving, the spring? What's happening to it? Well, if we go to the underlying interaction, we have a term in the Hamiltonian which looks like the intensity times position. This is radiation pressure force, light bouncing off the mirror. If I pump this system with a laser that's displacing the vacuum with a large oscillating coherent state, I replace this field value now with a classical term from the pump, which is oscillating at an optical frequency, plus the quantum field from the cavity mode. And if I look at the term which couples the quantum field of the cavity to the position of the oscillator, that's the cross term between these two. That's the beating of the two fields. And even though this is up at 100 terahertz, and this is also close to 100 terahertz, the beating between them can be only a megahertz. And so I can create an oscillating force which drives this spring. This is a parametric coupling. I'm frequency converting from a megahertz to 100 terahertz and back. Similarly, if I move the spring back and forth, it will mix with the pump and produce sidebands of light. But the cavity is asymmetric. I don't produce equal amounts of power above and below. I produce more power near the resonance of the cavity. The key point here is I started with a very weak but nonlinear interaction. I put on a strong classical pump. I drive it to a steady state non-equilibrium scenario. And in that steady state scenario, I have a very large linear coupling left. So large that you can do a wide variety of things like normal mode coupling between the oscillator and the mechanics, which you need a polariton to describe the system. You can do laser cooling and other such fun things. But the key point of optomechanics is this ability to start with very small nonlinear couplings and drive them into very large linear couplings. Why do we want to do these things? Well, if I'm a quantum information person, I might want to get information from one device to another device. But I can't copy the information because of the no-cloning theorem. If I copy it, I'm going to unavoidably add noise. So I want to send the state wholesale without any touching of it. And to do that, I need to actually transduce my information. Now, many quantum bits operate down in the megahertz to gigahertz domain. But if I want to send information over long distances, optical fibers are one of the best options available. So I might like to move up to optical domain to do that. And so I need a good transducer, something that takes me from a good quantum memory over here to a good quantum memory over there without measuring it or dephasing it in any way. And my contention is that these optomechanical devices are going to be one of our best options towards this regime. Because I'm also at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, where we do a lot of measurement science, there's another nice analog here, which is that I often get a signal which is extremely weak. And it's in a medium or a domain which is hard to measure. And I might like to convert that signal before adding any amplifier noise and then start amplifying it. So I need some sort of quantum transducer to losslessly convert an incoming signal to some other system which I can measure very efficiently. So here, now briefly, a few examples. One thing that you can do using this optomechanical interaction is monitor acceleration. So you have to imagine I have a large rigid mass down here. I have a small mass on top. There's two springs. So if I drive the rigid support with an acceleration, the mass stays behind and it starts wiggling. If this is one half of a Fabry-Perot cavity, then I can detect the position by monitoring the changes of the resonance frequency. And from a sort of practical technological perspective, this is extremely useful. Because it turns out that the acceleration is directly proportional to the position with a proportionality constant at low frequencies is given by the mechanical resonance frequency of this object. This means that if you have the ability to monitor the change in the wavelength of light and to determine the frequency of the oscillator, you can directly measure acceleration, referencing it to the system international, the system of units that we use. So this is a so-called self-calibrating accelerometer, which is in contrast to the accelerometers that we're carrying with us right now in our computers and in our phones, which are done electrically, where the ability to connect to the actual acceleration standard is done by sort of a transfer approach and has fraught with difficulties, it turns out. This, by the way, is an example of the prototype device that John Pratt's group built to try these ideas out, where we sort of have world's best sensitivity over world's largest bandwidth. The other thing you might want to do is learn more about the universe. So I started life as an astrophysicist before switching to quantum optics and quantum information. And one of the challenges in astrophysics is understanding more about the cosmic microwave background radiation. But the problem with the cosmic microwave background radiation is that it's pretty low temperature. It's about 2.7 Kelvin. So if I want to measure it very well, I need an amplifier that's sufficiently cold compared to the background. The way that's done with Planck or with COBE or with these other satellites is I have a liquid helium supply to keep it cryogenic, and I can do my experiment wonderfully until my helium evaporates, and then I'm done. But it turns out that you might be able to design a device, in fact, we have an approach for doing this now, where you can use one of these transducers to transduce radio frequency signals to optical signals in order to achieve an effective additional noise of all your other circuitry that's well below the thermal background, even though your overall device is at room temperature. In essence, what you're doing is you're looking at a very cold portion of the sky, and you're directly transducing that quantum signal up through a series of electrical and mechanical circuits to an optical signal, adding a minimum amount of noise along the way, and then you start amplifying. And if you do it this way, you can actually do very good low-temperature radio frequency measurements. This also leads the way to a sort of universal interface. So you have your optomechanical system here, where you've got an optical cavity and a mechanical device in the middle, which is changing the resonance frequency. The interaction, again, is this sort of pump-enhanced parametric mixing between position and field. Then you put a capacitor around this moving object. And so the moving object changes the capacitance, much like in Theremin's thing. That change in capacitance, when it's part of a resonant circuit, here this inductance represents a high-quality factor antenna, leads to a coupling between the charge on the plates and the position. That's the variable capacitance. And again, I put a large voltage on, much like I do with this microphone. I apply a voltage by turning the power on. And that large voltage displaces the classical to a classical field, and there's the quantum fluctuations on top. And this, in fact, provides a sort of universal interface, a versatile interface from arbitrary frequency signals down here in the radio frequency to microwave to a sort of any wavelength of light that you can build a good cavity with. To do this at the quantum level, however, is particularly challenging because you need to go into the quantum regime. And the key point about the quantum regime is the following. Quantum regime is defined as the regime in which you can transduce a cold source, and it requires that the dephasing be slow. Basically, by slow, I mean that the dephasing rate is at least slower than the mechanical frequency. So I get a period of oscillation before dephasing, which for a thermal oscillator, an oscillator at some temperature, corresponds to the addition or subtraction of a single thermal phonon. Now that's a pretty fast rate. It's the nominal damping rate multiplied by the number of thermal phonons plus a half for the quantum effects. If you're at high temperature, as most of the mechanical systems are compared to the mechanical frequency, this translates into the product of the quality factor of the oscillator times the frequency of the oscillator has to be much larger than temperature. To give it in experimentalist units, you need to make a Q frequency product that exceeds 7 terahertz if you want to do quantum stuff with mechanics at room temperature. Now, amazingly, several groups now have built devices with Q frequency products at room temperature that are about 70 terahertz. So there are now devices in the laboratory where people can actually require the use of quantum mechanics to understand them, even though they're sort of nanogram or picogram oscillators and they're at high temperature. And then, you know, you can try and do this in the lab. This is a collaboration with Eugene Polzik's group in Denmark, where they've built one of these coated membranes. They've coated it with some aluminum with a hole in the middle to let light through. The aluminum basically metallizes the membrane. It makes it interact strongly with the capacitor plate. There's a capacitor plate underneath the membrane here. You can't really see it. You also can't actually see the membrane because it's so thin. But you can see the aluminum on top. This is hooked up to a tuning capacitor and an inductor, which is essentially our antenna. And then you can start to drive the system electrically and monitor it optically. And when you do that as a function of the voltage you apply, this increases the electromechanical coupling, you basically see this onset of the LC response getting a sudden dip right in the middle. And that is where the incoming electrical signal is being efficiently transduced, converted to a mechanical signal, bypassing the LC circuit entirely. This is called mechanically induced transparency. It's the mechanical equivalent to optically induced transparency in atoms. It's a very narrow feature, basically because the mechanical system is extremely high quality factor. And this enables this group to basically build a device that outperforms the best op-amps over a very narrow bandwidth, but still at room temperature. So now let me motivate how everything I just told you is extremely boring. And obviously, some of you have already assumed that, but the rest of you, I'd now like to bring you to the same page. Why is it boring? It's all linear physics. I mean, I did a little bit of cheating where I started with nonlinearity and then made it linear. But by linear physics, I basically mean that I have a system whose Hamiltonian is described by a bilinear combination of various creation and annihilation operators. So by diagonalizing this matrix, I can exactly solve this problem in polynomial time, even though the Hilbert space dimension is infinitely large for each oscillator, and I have n of these Hilbert spaces tensor producted together. But none of that was relevant for determining the equations of motion in the Heisenberg picture for this system. And in fact, Ehrenfest theorem becomes exact in this limit. So linear systems are sort of fundamentally boring with a small proviso, which is, of course, you can actually do something interesting in the state preparation and measurement side. It's just that the dynamics are trivial. So this is the basis of Scott Aronson's matrix permanent calculator. It's not about what happens in here, it's about how you prepare the system. But I'm instead interested in making this thing a little bit more interesting. In particular, I want to go to the nonlinear regime. In the nonlinear regime, I just mean that the equations of motion now have terms which are at least quadratic in operators, so that I have to track correlation functions. And Ehrenfest theorem becomes less useful because I can no longer factorize these mean values. And these nonlinear systems, of course, sort of the beginning of many-body physics. And as you all know, when you start going down that rabbit hole, it's not clear that you ever really return. Nonetheless, we'll try and go there for a little bit. So towards that end, I'm going to talk now about how we can engineer, using our linear physics, quantum Hall type physics, and then add interactions to hopefully get into the quantum Hall regime, the fractional quantum Hall regime, where we might be able to see physics associated with non-abelian particles. I feel maybe that this is, for this audience, this slide is extraneous, but I'll say it anyway. If you didn't already know, in 3+1 dimensions, there are no knots. That is to say, if I start with a string in 2+1 dimensions, I can tie them in knots. That's no problem. If I look at a string in 3+1 dimensions, well, it's convenient to just take that string and bring it down to a point. And if I have 2 points, I can't tie a knot with 2 points. So in particular, when I go halfway around in 3+1 dimensions and then back, I have to get the identity because I can't tie knots. And that means that the only types of particles allowed to me are those when I exchange them twice, I get the identity back, which means that I either a +1 when I go halfway or a -1 when I go halfway. This gives me bosons and fermions. But in 2+1 dimensions, I have knots. I have the whole Jones polynomial and Braid group that I have to worry about. And now I can have any type of physics or any type of statistics associated with the exchange, and thus they get so-called anions. And we'd like to see these anions. We'd like to see the effects of braiding and the non-triviality of the Braid group, and in principle even perhaps do quantum computation this way. But to do that, we're going to have to work extremely hard. I'm going to start now by briefly reviewing the quantum Hall effect, then talk about how we do it with photons. So as you know, when I have got non-interacting electrons in a two-dimensional system with a magnetic field, I get the exact solutions to this problem. These are the Landau levels. They're highly degenerate. So if I look at the density states as a function of energy, I basically get Landau levels separated by sort of cyclotron energies. And when I move the Fermi, when I move these density states through a Fermi level, I'm going to get a sudden peak in the conductance, just as you might expect. Meanwhile, in between these peaks, I have a conductance through the edge of the system, which is quantized. And this arises because I started with a system which is actually a conductor at zero magnetic field. And then I start applying magnetic field, and its conductor-like properties have suddenly turned into a band insulator. But that's not allowed topologically, and so I actually have at the edge a little strip of metal, if you will. And this little strip of metal is, of course, the edge states. So how do we get this magnetic field for our non-interacting particles? Well, the key is to understand that the magnetic field arises from the fact that the generator of translation in a magnetic field is not the mechanical momentum per se, but it's the canonical momentum, right? The mechanical momentum minus the gauge field. So when I go over a closed path, I just multiply several of these translation operators together. All the P's cancel if I make a closed loop, but the A's don't necessarily. I just sum up over the line integral associated with the different parts of that path. And of course, I recognize this as the line integral of the synthetic or the gauge potential around a loop, or alternatively, the magnetic flux through the loop. So to produce a magnetic field, it suffices to have my generator of translations have a non-trivial phase, a phase which has curl to it. It's worth mentioning that any Hamiltonian where you can add a momentum term, p dot alpha, where alpha is some constant of motion, is going to behave in this way if alpha depends upon position. And this leads to, for example, the spin Hall effect, where you have a spin orbit interaction, which leads to a coupling between the momentum sector. And that looks like a magnetic field, unless you get spin Hall systems. I'm interested in photons, as mentioned by a few other people, particularly Duncan Haldane and Marin Silvich. My colleagues at the JQI are particularly interested in doing this with atoms. In both cases, our problem is that we have neutral particles. So magnetic field is not going to do very much for us if we actually use magnetic field. Instead, we have to make a synthetic field. We're going to do it on a lattice, which means that you actually want to rewrite this story in terms of just hopping particles on a lattice where I have a non-trivial hopping phase. By non-trivial, again, I mean that this A has a curl. This problem has exact solution, which is the Hofstadter butterfly. It's actually one of the first examples of a fractal in physics. This is magnetic field, this is energy, and in the vertical axis is density of states. And what you see is you get these Landau bands, these are Landau levels at low flux per plaquette, And then as you go to higher flux per plaquette, you get these bifurcations into a self-similar structure. And this is the type of thing that we'd also love to see, which is that the effects of the Hofstede butterfly have this self-similar structure. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to report on that in this talk. It's worth mentioning that, again, these Landau levels are sort of the conducting bands of the system. And then in between are these topological insulating regions, regions where we expect to find edge states. The technology of choice for us is going to be waveguides based on silicon, using a silicon-on-insulator technology, a standard technology from the semiconductor industry. And we're going to see how we can actually implement and engineer a magnetic field for the photons using this approach. So I want you to consider an optical resonator. And the optical resonator has modes that are clockwise circulation and a counterclockwise circulation that are degenerate with each other. This is just like a whispering gallery mode, if you will. I'm going to have several of these resonators that are at the same frequency with each other, so I can build a tight binding model where photons hop from site to site. But in between, the hopping is going to go through a waveguide, such that when I'm going here clockwise, I go along the bottom to go to the next resonator. And when I come back, I go along the top. This is actually very straightforward to do with linear optics. And now if I just change the optical phase I pick up along the top compared to along the bottom, I have, when the photon hops leftward, a different phase from when it hops rightward. So my underlying Hamiltonian has a term of the form e to the I 2 pi alpha, which is the effective magnetic field. And then I'm going to want this phase to vary with position in some two-dimensional lattice, so I have a curl. So I'm going to change this length difference as a function of the y-index of this two-dimensional lattice. And that's going to make a Landau gauge. Now, I haven't broken time reversal symmetry here. And in particular, what I told you for clockwise photons is opposite for counterclockwise photons. So the helicity is my pseudo-spin degree of freedom. And it's the helicity that's going to be determined up in here. So if I flip the clockwise counterclockwise, I also flip the sign of the magnetic field. This is really a spin Hall system, not a quantum Hall system. What do you expect if you build this type of system? Well, you can calculate the transmission coefficient. The transmission on a finite size torus is going to be that of the Hofstede butterfly. Of course, if you're an experimentalist, implementing a torus is still challenging, though it may be possible for photons. If you do it instead on a two-dimensional square, then you get these edge states in the system. So if you try and pump the system in the edge state region, when you're in these insulating regions, you see that the pointing vector of the light goes along the edge. And these systems, because there are no bulk states, are extremely insensitive to impurities. Any impurity tries to scatter me into the bulk, but there's no density of states there. And so I come right back out. So if I, in simulation, induce an impurity by just removing a resonator or detuning a resonator here, then the light, in fact, in the edge just routes around that impurity. And this is this robustness of the edge to local defects and local errors. Now, I chose silicon as a test tool because we can actually implement this in the laboratory. And so I particularly want to thank Mohamed Hafezi, my postdoc, who decided to take off his theorist hat and put on his experimentalist hat and spend 2 years in the lab and do this. So this is one of the devices that he fabricated. This is a large array of ring resonators. This 10 micron scale bar is for what you see inside this box. And you have rings that are sort of longer rectangularly left-right. Those are the resonators. And then ones that are longer north-south or up-down, those are the waveguides. As you go up vertically along this axis, you slightly offset the top and the bottom of these waveguides. And that induces the Landau gauge. There's a laser that's pumping light through down into the system through this input port here. It's going to circulate around this way or into the bulk, and then come out the other side to an analyzer. And you also have a microscope. And the microscope has an in-gas camera on top that's going to be able to measure infrared light coming out of this thing. You're working at 1.55 microns, so you can't do it visibly. And that will allow you to image where the light is going in the device. When you actually go to take an image, they're pretty ugly. So this is what happens if you pump the system in one of the bulk regions. You basically just get some quasi-localized state trying to push into the bulk. You do aperture photometry on each of these little rings here, and you get this picture now here, which has been reduced in order to capture all the light from each of the rings. You're going to see a lot of this in a moment. This tells you what you expect to see, what you're actually seeing experimentally. So the experiment has slightly lower magnetic field than the original goal, but that's fine. You can do the simulation of what you expect when you pump on the long edge and the short edge of the system. They're basically chiral pairs to each other, so one's on one frequency side, one's on the other. And what you see is when you pump here, that you expect to go along the bottom on the long side here. You pump here, you go along the top when you're on this side here. So then you go and you do that in the lab, and you see here again that the long edge goes around like this and the short edge goes like this, pretty much as we expect. The main difference between these simulations and the experiment is that in the simulations, we allowed for various disorder, but we didn't include that the group index varies from device to device, which basically corresponds to a local fluctuation of magnetic field. Once you include local fluctuation magnetic field, we now think that we can have a better accounting for why this is a bit more spread out here than it is here. We can also check the robustness by accidentally removing a resonator. So here, there's no link resonator in the middle. That should be a device where I could hop to, and it's missing. So the theoretical simulation suggests that you hop right around it. The actual experiment also goes right around it. We get reasonable output here. It's hard to see visually because you're on a linear scale, but you understand that when you look at this in spectral sense, you've got 40 dB worth of dynamic range, and you're only down by about 10 dB here. So quite a bit is getting through. So that's kind of just a demonstration that you can engineer the system. So now, we did all that effort. Now, let's get nonlinearity in there. I'm particularly inspired to look at nonlinearity, in part because of some beautiful work that Greiter, Zhaogang, and Frank Wilczek did some many years ago, where they showed the exact ground state for particles in a magnetic field with a three-body interaction can be the Pfaffian state. So you have this nu equals 1 for bosons. You have a scenario where two particles coming together, nothing happens. Three particles coming together, and they scatter off each other. Now, this is not easy to do in natural systems, because all the natural systems we have are essentially based off of perturbative QED, where I start with two-body, and then I get build up from two-body to get to more two-body to more two-body, and eventually, maybe with strong correlations, I can get to three-body. But we're going to engineer three-body directly. Of course, we have to solve these problems of engineering the magnetic field, and I showed you one way to do that, and developing a strong three-particle interaction, which we're about to do. The problem is the one of obviousness, as related in this sort of typical American story of bank robbers. So there's this bank robber, Willie Sutton. He was reasonably good, eventually got caught. He was asked by some reporters why he robbed banks, and his response was very simple. That's where the money is. Well, in a similar way, if you had asked him whether he wanted to do his quantum Hall physics with light in the optical domain or light in the microwave domain, he would very naturally reply, well, of course I'm going to use microwaves, because that's where the nonlinearity is. What do I mean by that? Well, these superconducting devices have metals where I can confine the light to a mode volume that is much smaller than the wavelength of light cubed. This should be no surprise to anyone. You have a coaxial cable. The transverse dimensions of a coax cable are much, much smaller than the wave it supports. And this works because the metal supports the excitation, right? You have a central line of metal. Now, if we had metals that worked well at optical frequencies, you could do beautiful QED physics at optical frequencies really simply. But unfortunately, we don't. In contrast, in the microwave domain, we have superconductors. And these superconductors provide a great opportunity to dramatically concentrate the electric field per photon in a device. So this is a typical strip line resonator. This is basically a waveguide, very narrow waveguide, meandering down the chip. And it has capacitive boundary conditions, so you just have a standing wave. And now your mode volume is orders of magnitude smaller than wavelength cubed. Furthermore, these superconductors are extremely low loss, so you have very long lifetimes and dephasing times for your photons. And then the last trick is that you have Josephine junctions. So you have this overlap of a superconductor, dielectric, and superconductor, by which you have a superconducting phase slip that's best described by a potential which looks like a cosine of the flux. So if I had a small amount of flux here, I would expand this cosine term. I would get a term that looks like an inductor. And then I get a term that's quadratic. Quartic in the flux. This is the nonlinear term. The energy scales here are very large. EJ is maybe 100 gigahertz. You're working down at a few gigahertz. So your intrinsic nonlinearity is through the roof. And this opens up a wide variety of opportunities. In the words of Rob Schulkoff and Steve Girvan, strong coupling is easy in these systems. And what we're going to do is look at what happens with a fluxonium qubit, which is a large inductor hooked up in parallel to a Josephine junction. And this system actually looks quite a lot like an LC circuit, just an inductor capacitor. These Josephine junctions have a built-in capacitance to them because they have two pieces of metal with a piece of dielectric in between. As you might expect, the spectrum looks largely harmonic, and it either looks like a series of levels with a slight shift associated with having two excitations compared to one, or a series of levels with a slight shift associated with having three excitations compared to one. That is to say, actually the best description of this problem is that of a harmonic oscillator with a two-body interaction and a three-body interaction. Quite amazingly, when you bias this system up to a near pi worth of flux, you discover this dashed line here. This dashed line, so this is the U2 parameter, this is the U3 parameter. The dashed line is the zero of U2, no two-body interaction at all. And you still have on the order of a few hundred megahertz to a few gigahertz worth of U3. So you can have a system with an intrinsic frequency of a few gigahertz and a three-body interaction of a few gigahertz. And this sets you up now for getting to the Fafian. With one small proviso, I need a magnetic field. And unfortunately, my clockwise, counterclockwise story doesn't really work for standing wave modes that are a single wavelength. Right? For clockwise and counterclockwise to be able to sort of couple while keeping their helicity, I need a coupling region that's much longer than the wavelength. I need some sort of quasi-phase matching or momentum conservation condition. But for waveguides that are a single wavelength, that doesn't work anymore. So instead, we're going to go back into our bag of tricks and go back to that parametric coupling, that frequency conversion that you saw at the beginning of the talk. So you're going to imagine building a lattice of these devices. Each of these here is one of these three photon interacting qubits. There's several different colors representing different frequencies that these qubits are resonant at. And in between are going to be these DC squid couplers. And the DC squid coupler is going to basically produce a magnetic phase. This was first really outlined in an optical paper by Shang-Wei Fan's group, except they wanted to do it just classically with about 10 dB of loss per coupler. We'd like to do it quantum mechanically with no loss. So again, we go to microwaves. The idea is very simple. You have two different colors here, two oscillators, one at frequency omega, one at omega plus nu. And you have a nonlinear coupling between them. And you drive the nonlinear coupling at a frequency nu, the difference between these two, with a phase theta. And so when the coupling is weak compared to the resonance frequency, you can make a rotating wave approximation, and you get a hopping with a phase set by the phase of the oscillator in the parametric amplifier. And setting oscillator phase is something that is one of the easiest things to do experimentally. So it becomes very straightforward to implement a phase shift as a function of position in this type of system and thus implement your Landau gauge. So I guess I'll say you put this all together, and in principle now you have the opportunity to set up a system that will enter into the fractional quantum Hall regime using microwave photons. Now in the very last portion of my talk, I'm going to switch gears a little bit and ask a little bit of a deeper question about transduction. So I talked about how you want to move quantum information from point A to point B. But you might ask, how do you know that you did anything? How do you know that it was quantum information that was moving about? And this led us to think a little bit more deeply about the meaning of communication. And in particular, I'd like to just go back to basics. And as you all recall, if I assume Lorentz invariance is important to me, then whatever Lagrangian I'm going to write down is going to be local. So something like the Coulomb interaction only is going to arise by integrating out local gauge fields. I'm not going to get it intrinsically into the Lagrangian. Very simplistically, you can always understand this by thinking about a single harmonic oscillator, some A, couple it to two systems, one held by Alice over here with position x1, one held by Bob over here with position x2. I just apply a displacement transformation of this harmonic oscillator. So that shifts A to this A minus a small correction factor. And that removes the linear coupling. And I'm left now with this term, which represents the direct coupling of A to B, for Alice to Bob, via this virtual field that I've eliminated. And so we're all very familiar with this at some level. It's just a matter of whether you've seen it in this language or in the path integral language, whatever way you'd like to think about it. So you could also say that this force law is a communication channel. If I wiggle Alice's particle, then Bob's going to see some wiggling, because Alice is inducing a force on Bob. Now we can ask, what's the difference between a classical communication channel and a quantum communication channel? And what is the difference between a classical force and a quantum force? So basically, you have to imagine now in time, here's Alice emitting her virtual particle to Bob. Bob sends a virtual particle back to Alice. Alice sends a virtual particle back to Bob, and they continue to communicate in this way. And this continuous channel of communication is a means by which they establish the force law that you observe. But if it was a classical force, then the key point would be that you put a screen in the middle here to make certain that no entanglement gets through, but everything else works fine. It's a hypothetical object that's going to be very convenient for us from a theoretical perspective. I don't expect these things exist in nature. I'm just saying that if you wanted to check whether it was a classical channel or not, you'd look for this screen. Now, screens are going to be very tightly constrained because they first of all have to reproduce the classical or the Ehrenfest type dynamics that you expect in the system. So if I wiggle on this particle, the other one better move. But they also need to make certain to let no entanglement through. And that's going to put very tight constraints on what you can do for a screen. Nonetheless, it turns out that there's an optimal screen choice for this simple single oscillator model, which is what in experimental physics we call heterodyne measurement. But here I'll present it as an incoming boson. They split on a beam splitter. So you have vacuum on this port and incoming boson on that port. Then you take a local oscillator, put this on a beam splitter, and measure the difference of these two signals. Same thing here with the pi over 2 phase shift. This is a way to simultaneously attempt to measure the x and the p parts of this incoming boson. Now, as you can immediately assume, if I could do that perfectly, I can now recreate this boson by taking the vacuum and displacing it based on my measurement outcomes. Because I know that the state was most likely a coherent state, and it most likely had an x quadrature of this and a p quadrature of that. But the problem, of course, is that this procedure is going to unavoidably add noise because I can't measure x and p simultaneously. And the way I cheat to do it here is I introduce this vacuum port. And so I don't measure x and p. I measure x1 plus x2 and p1 minus p2. But in doing so, I add a small amount of noise. We call this vacuum noise in quantum optics. Or sometimes you call it amplifier noise. It's the minimum noise that any phase-insensitive amplifier has to add. And essentially, the requirement that classical dynamics works is the same as the requirement that you have to be able to send both x and p information through. And that means that any such classical force is going to add some noise. To see this a little bit more formally, you can set up a Gnonkin experiment taking a page from the ion trappers. So they use these phase gates. So I want some interaction between Alice and Bob, where A is an operator in Alice's space and B is an operator in Bob's space. And I can implement that by just a set of interactions where first I boost the ancillary oscillator, the force carrier, by an amount given by A times root tau. That pushes it up here in space. Then I boost, or rather displace it by an amount given by B. So I've sort of made a copy, if you will, of the information about A and the information about B temporarily in my virtual particle. Now I come back down in A, and I come back down in B, and I close the loop. So no information is left in this virtual particle, but this path encloses an area. So I pick up a phase, e to the I tau AB, which you can recognize as an approximation to the dynamics generated by this interaction. So I can think about a circuit where I interact with A and then B with the virtual carrier in the middle here, and then A and then B again. That's exactly what I just showed you. And now I insert in the middle a screen, which can be any quantum channel I like, so long as it doesn't let entanglement through. And this allows me to now look over all possible screens, what the consequences are going to be. And the key point you should take away is that when you do this type of measurement, you necessarily get an increase in the variance of the conjugate variables to the interaction variables. So if x is the interaction term for Alice, then in P, there's going to be noise added. Just to give you a sense of what this means, just consider the case where Alice and Bob are harmonic oscillators with some mass m and some frequency. And then they interact with a position-position interaction, so just a typical force interaction, with a prefactor, a little g. Then what you find is that the variance of their momenta is increasing in time, given by a rate proportional to the coupling. So the more you try to communicate, the more noise you add, if your communications aren't quantum. And it doesn't matter what classical communication you want to try, you can do no better than this bound. And the other nice feature of this paper is that if you're less than this, then we actually have a constructive approach for purifying the entanglement that you get using non-Gaussian operations to make an arbitrarily well-entangled system. So this is the bound. If you can see, show that your noise is below this inequality, then the channel of communication that your systems are using necessarily communicates quantum information. So we can immediately go and say, well, what about gravity? Does gravity communicate quantum information? Now, I expect the answer to be yes. But we have no a priori reason to believe it's yes or no yet. So let's ask that question. You can imagine a setup, like a Cavendish experiment. I've got an oscillating dumbbell here. It's a very low frequency torsional oscillator. It just goes back and forth. And I have two of them very near each other. And I can find that the gravitational coupling between them is bounded by some material properties. So you have the Newton's constant here, big G, the density of the material. Unfortunately, we're quite limited in material densities in terrestrial environments to about 22 or so grams per centimeter cubed, if you want to do it with good mechanical properties, divided by the frequency of these oscillators. And this is a very small number on top. Everything with big G is always going to be very small, right? So if you design these oscillators using the sort of state-of-the-art and torsion balance experiments of the type that they do at University of Washington, then you discover this frequency is on the order of 1 to 10 millihertz, so if that 100 to 1,000 seconds for a period. And you get an excess heating rate due to gravity, if gravity was classical, if gravity didn't communicate quantum information, which would be about one phonon every 3,000 seconds. Now, if you imagine doing this in a dilution refrigerator system at 10 millikelvin, you're dealing with a thermal background of one phonon every 10 seconds. So that's a tremendous, tremendous background. I mean, you've tried so hard already. This is devices with a Q factor of 10 to the 8 and a frequency of 1 millihertz, which means that they ring down on my lifetime. Okay? They're extremely hard to build devices. But nonetheless, people are actually building these now. And the question is, can you distinguish this excess phonon against that background? And if you work hard at it, you begin to realize that there's a procedure. You want to verify that the two systems are coupled by gravity, so you want to vary their position vertically. That is the sort of witness that the communication is gravity and not something else. You want to estimate their heating rate over this sort of 3,000 second time scale, and then you just need to repeat maybe 10 to the 7, maybe 10 to the 8 times. That's a long time, 100,000 years. Yes? You're welcome to reduce the temperature. Then the scaling with temperature is as temperature squared. So if you reduce the temperature by a factor of 10, you reduce the time scale by a factor of 100. To paraphrase Sir Mix-a-Lot, not at a milligram. So, unfortunately, there are ways to improve this experiment. I wanted to do it with what was existing technology to see where you could go before we go to a technology that doesn't yet exist. And so this is very hard, right? That's 100,000 years, except it's an embarrassingly parallel experiment. Every experiment takes only about 3,000 seconds. You just need to do a lot of them. And so in physics, we know a lot about doing the same experiment lots of times, right? We can build one detector 10,000 times. So what we're looking at now is how small can we make these oscillators, and can we do it with a nanofabrication process so that we can build one chip with 10,000 oscillators on it rather than trying to build a collaboration the size of LIGO or CERN. So I just want to leave you with a few key points. First of all, I've talked a bit about how we can really engineer and control the properties of phonons and photons. And I think there's really interesting opportunities going forward for room temperature quantum interfaces and dealing with quantum mechanics with massive optics at room temperature as we build better materials, as we get past these Q frequency limits that people have now achieved. And we'll see where that goes. I'm also very excited not just about this sort of circuit QED simulation of the fractional quantum Hall, but also, first of all, other fractional quantum Hall states going to four-body interaction, Reed-Rezai states, and also lattice gauge theories. A lot of what we talk about here can be implemented to larger, more interesting systems. And then finally, I've suggested that this noise-based entanglement test is going to be useful for gravity, but it's actually useful for a wide variety of other things because it turns out to be generally much easier to do in the lab than a Bell's inequality test. But yet, it provides roughly the same information. It tells me that these two things can be entangled by the way in which they're coupled. And also, there might be much better ways for testing the quantum nature of gravity with this little bit of extra knowledge now added in. I just want to highlight, once again, Mohamed Hafezi's work. He's responsible for pretty much everything you saw about fractional quantum Hall. And Prabin Adhikari, who was the student working on that same project. Devir Kaffery, who did this work with me on the gravitational stuff. And Junong, who did the work on alpha mechanics. And Sunil, who was the experimental student working with Mamad on the experimental work. Thank you very much for your time.
So we like to give students the first chance for questions. So any students have questions? No? We can throw it open to questions from everybody then. Let me ask my question first, which is this gravity thing. To what extent does it depend on the screen that cuts entanglement being something that behaves according to the rules of quantum mechanics itself?
So the constraints on the screen are indeed that it is overall information conserving, as in I can write it down as a master equation, as part of a master equation. Mm-hmm. And we do that because we're trying to replicate actually the classical dynamics of the system. Non-unitary theories and non-local theories circumvent the screen. So, but if we keep unitarity and locality, then you're quite restricted.
Thank you. In the standard quantum Hall effect, Pauli principle plays a very important role in filling up Landau levels and
yes.
so on.
Yes.
And also for the paired Hall state. So how do you manage with light? How do you change the statistics?
Okay, so in the linear experiments, it's actually non-interacting theory. So you just choose your frequency of light, and you probe the density of states at that frequency.
Well, it's just probing the density of states, not just,
there's no Fermi level or anything, because it's just, first of all, it's a non-interacting system. Mm. But second of all, it's bosons. Right? And so you just look where does light go through, at what frequencies does it go through. In the interacting case, I can talk with you more about it later. We have a new approach, which I'm not presenting here, for generating a chemical potential for photons using these parametric converters. And that actually works very nicely with the system I already showed you.
I see.
So that basically, you just add a chemical potential term by upconverting low-frequency light to high-frequency light. And this chemical potential term lets you set the occupation number. Of course, in the fractional quantum Hall regime, you know, photons, fermions and bosons actually have a lot of similarities to each other. So I'm not so worried about the absence of Pauli exclusion there.
May I ask another short question? There is a competing cold atom experiments.
Yes.
Where they tried to...
By my colleague down the road, down the hall.
So how are you faring compared to them?
Oh, yes. So what's very nice about for us, basically there's a set of experiments done by Ian Spielman and now several competitors like Jean Dalibar, where they're looking at spin Hall systems with cold atoms, which have a certain nice property. Atoms like to interact compared to photons. Photons don't like to interact at all. And so in that respect, they're coming in naturally with interactions. But they suffer from two real challenges. And one of them is it's very hard to get high magnetic flux. The flux is limited fundamentally by how much momentum two laser beams can transfer to atoms. And that's basically limited by what we can produce with light and what atoms interact with. So you just can't get a lot of flux per atom in the system. It's hard to get to reasonable filling factors. In contrast, in the lattice system with this synthetic gauge as we've engineered it, it's much easier. Now, there's another set of cold atom experiments by Wolfgang Ketterle's group where they're trying to do it on a lattice to get to these higher filling fractions. But then atoms on a lattice are actually now weakly interacting again. And so we think that this is going to be somewhat complementary, but for certain regimes, this is maybe going to perform better.
You have this proposal using this resonant ring to simulate a magnetic field.
Yes.
And the thing says you need to break time reversal symmetry. By changing the shape of the ring, seems don't do that. I wonder what's
Again, for the case of the rings,
yeah,
the optical work that showed the theory and the experiment,
yeah,
we're not breaking time reversal symmetry. We're not doing quantum Hall. We're doing spin Hall.
I see.
Okay, so it's actually a spin orbit term that we've turned on. And the pseudospin here is a clockwise circulation or counterclockwise circulation. So you can think of it also that I'm using spin polarized samples.
I see.
Right? I'm pumping with one directionality of light, and that breaks the time reversal symmetry in terms of my state preparation. But it's really the spin Hall system.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
So I wonder, how does the requirement change if you use a more massive object in your experiment for gravity test?
Oh, so for gravity, it turns out that it's the density that matters, not the mass. And so, again, the goal here is to get largest communication rate. You know, you can look at the communication rate, for example, between the Earth and the Moon by gravity. Right. So that system, a little bit of motion, wiggling of the Moon in its orbit will influence the Earth's orbit. It translates to about one phonon every 10,000 seconds. Of course, a phonon of the Earth system is a very small amount of energy. and so you can't see it there. So it turns out you actually want to get to equal masses, and then you just want to get a system where they're not so small that Casimir starts winning, right? But not so large that your system doesn't fit inside a dilution refrigerator. So the current Ito-Wash experiments are actually roughly the size of what fits inside a dill fridge. And these are the ones at University of Washington with single oscillators. I'd like to think we could make them smaller, so we're working on that now. I guess just as a brief follow-on, what we're talking about here is not nonlinear theories, and it's not semi-classical gravity, and it's not Newton-Schrodinger equation, and it's not a wide variety of other things people have proposed where the mass matters a lot. So, and I'm not trying to look at Planck scale physics. There's nothing here about getting a mass whose energy scale is comparable to the Planck scale. None of that enters here. This is all about sort of right near the semi-classical limit of gravity, right about the point where perturbative gravitons make sense. And so in some sense, it's a very lowball set of questions to ask. But on the other hand, it's the first time we think we can do it rigorously.
Any more questions? Okay, then let's thank Jake again.